It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, it's Food Friday. A Native American chef shares ingredients, recipes, and cultural traditions from indigenous communities in the Midwest and beyond. First, a recent report from the Wisconsin Policy Forum found local government debt is at record levels here in the state. The state's biggest cities had the most debt, but debt grew the fastest in towns, raising the possibility that someday communities big and small in Wisconsin might have to cut back on key services like libraries and police to catch up. Our next guest sees this happening across the country. He argues a big part of the problem is the way our communities are designed, saying things like sprawl and large-scale development have left us with more infrastructure costs than local governments can afford. In order to make communities financially stable, he wants us to embrace a more incremental, one-step-at-a-time style of development where small improvements are made over time. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What does development look like in your community? Do you need a car to get around where you live? Is all the new stuff a big development, whether it's commercial or residential, on the outskirts of town? Or are you seeing cool stuff happen in the downtown parts of your community? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@wpr.org. Charles Marone is an urban planner and former engineer. He's the founder and president of the nonprofit group Strong Towns. Chuck, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me. I'm happy to be here.
If I'm reading you right, you're looking for kind of a mindset change for how we think about development in communities, big and small. I want to start with what you see as the downsides of our current way of thinking, where we want that big new commercial development, the big new residential development, and we run our sewers and electrical out to it. Where do we start to go wrong there?
Yeah, I think this report too kind of highlights the signal is kind of the end game of this approach. What we've really tried to do is explain why cities struggle financially, because we have been conditioned to see cities that are growing and growing very quickly as being prosperous. If you have that new subdivision, if you have that new development, if you are getting that new big box store, your balance sheet looks good, you've got lots of cash, people are moving there, it's in a sense the place to be. But local governments take on, as they grow in this way, enormous promises for the future that are not reflected at all on their balance sheet. We have to maintain that road now. We have to maintain that sewer pipe. We have to someday fix that sidewalk. And when those promises start to come due, what we see is that there just is not enough tax base there. There's not enough wealth there. There's actually not enough there to fund all of those promises. And that's when cities start to get financially into a lot of trouble.
Now, you have some maps and graphics that I think were surprising to me. I think would be surprising to most people. You just looked at how much is the local government spending in a place versus how much is it taking in a place? Where are they making money? Where are they losing money? What do we learn when we start to look at charts like that?
It's amazing because this has been done, and there's a group called Urban 3 out of Asheville, North Carolina, that really pioneered this approach. Their principal is a good friend of mine, and we've sat down and looked at hundreds of different cities. And what we see time and time again is that the neighborhoods that were built prior to the Great Depression, and we can think of these as neighborhoods where people can walk, you don't have to walk. They still largely accommodate people driving and you know, modern American living. These are not places with horse and buggies, but they're older neighborhoods. They're neighborhoods built in a kind of a different way. They tend to be cash flow positive. Even when they're poor, even when they're occupied by very poor people, even when they're kind of run down, these places tend to generate more revenue for the community than they generate ongoing expenses. The further you get out from those core neighborhoods and the closer you get to today, the most modern stuff built is actually the worst. Over a life cycle, so not just, you know, the developer comes in and builds it and gives it to the city and the city has sent, gets it for free, but when the city actually has to go out and take care of stuff, the further you go out time to today, the more cash flow negative it becomes. The stuff we built the last 30 years is financially the most ruinous that cities have on their balance sheets.
And people might hear us say the word cities and think you're talking about big cities, you know, huge urban metropolitan areas. You do, you've done work in places like Lafayette, Louisiana, Brainerd, Minnesota, not, you know, not tiny towns, but not your big sprawling metropolis. These are things you're seeing in communities of a lot of different sizes.
It's absolutely. I mean, I'm from Brainerd. Brainerd's a city of 14,000. The questions that I, you know, explore at Strong Towns came out of my work here and recognizing that we were doing everything we could to grow very, very quickly. But financially, we were just a basket case. We didn't have any money to do anything. We laid off our fire department. We were cutting back the library hours. We were doing all this stuff that affected people's quality of life. Yet, you know, we just heard the Foxconn update. We were doing our own kind of Foxconn things here where we were out chasing that next development and chasing that next big thing. This is a cycle we see in cities of all sizes. And what you get in a large city is you, in a sense, have more going on. And so sometimes it's harder to, you know, figure out exactly where the money is sloshing around because there's a lot of different things. When you get into smaller cities, what you have is just a much more fragile system. Smaller cities have less fallback position. There's fewer Peters to rob to pay the Paul that you owe, in a sense. And so what we see in small towns is that the problems manifest a lot more quickly and a lot more urgently than they do in a large city.
We're talking to Charles Marone with the group Strong Towns, saying we need to rethink the way we think about growth in our towns and cities, big and small. That big project on the fringe may cost us more in the long run, maybe more than we can pay. That's part, he says, of what's driving many communities in Wisconsin and elsewhere into long-term debt. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions for our guest. Maybe you want to share something about your own local experience. 800-642-1234 is the number, or email ideas@wpr.org. Let's bring on a caller now. Samantha is with us in Menominee. Samantha, hi.
Hey there. I'm a big fan of the Strong Towns organization, and I was hoping your guest could provide listeners with a definition of the term strode, which I know is something that you guys have discussed as an organization, and how communities can use changes in zoning to prevent those kind of spaces from proliferating in our communities.
Samantha, thanks for the call. And that word strodes, I know you're familiar, Charles. It's street and road put together. It's big, fast-moving traffic in places like roads, in places where you want streets where there's a lot of pedestrian traffic. Can you talk a little more about strodes and how they can cause trouble?
Exactly. We were looking for a word to describe essentially the most expensive type of transportation investment we could make with the least amount of financial return. And, you know, we try to draw a distinction between a street and a road, a street being a platform for building wealth within a community. It's the framework for creating a place is a street. And a road is a connection between places. On a road, you want to move very quickly. On a street, you actually want things to slow down so you can thicken the place up and actually get a really good return on our public and private investments. A strode does neither of these. A strode, from a public balance sheet standpoint, is a really expensive thing to build. You've got multiple lanes, turning lanes. It's also the lowest returning style of development. So you tend to get strip malls, big box stores, things that I think in our minds, we think, oh, you know, you're doing really well if you can get the Walmart. Sure, the Walmart creates a lot of tax base. It creates a lot of cash flow for the city, but it comes at an enormous expense in terms of sewer and water and road and pipe and all of the infrastructure you've got to build and maintain. And these buildings tend to last, you know, a couple decades, and then they go away, and then you just have the cost with no revenue. And so the idea of a strode is to kind of recognize this specific type of transportation investment and associated pattern of development as being distinct and different from what you would find on a street or what you would find on a really well-designed road.
Thanks for that call. We'll go to Dave now in Sturgeon Bay. Hi, Dave.
Hi there. Sturgeon Bay just approved, I think it's about $700,000 to extend utilities down Highway 57 for the purpose of allowing a fleet farm development And there's other areas in the city that have adequate water, sewer, and probably a better retail area. But they did that. And in addition, in the state of Wisconsin, we amongst other states, but we have what's called dark store property tax fights, where the big boxes can claim, despite what they sell for on the open market, and I'm a developer, I understand what they sell for, that the big boxes can claim that they should be assessed as vacant, which then is huge tax giveaway to the big boxes who are going to go where their sales are regardless. And then that tax burden, of course, is passed on to the average taxpayer because you still have to pay for services. And then, yes, in 20 years, maybe the market moves on and maybe that store does go vacant. And now you have a vacant store that hasn't even paid its share of taxes all along the way.
Dave, thanks a lot for the call. Charles, Dave, seeing the life cycle of the big box store, do you see that, I guess, in effect, I guess, a government subsidy for that kind of development that Dave says doesn't pan out?
No, it's a huge government subsidy. And this gets into the commitment that cities make. When we go out and build a road as a community, so our local government, you know, the board of directors, in a sense, directing our municipal corporation, our city, the community we live in, goes out and makes an investment in a road and a pipe and drainage systems. Those are forever investments. They don't go away. You know, it's not like you're getting married and you say, well, you know, for the first life cycle, we're good. And then after that, it's going to, you know, this is an infinite investment that we make as a community. We promise that we will maintain all this stuff. And often we go and you see this with Fleet Farms will come in as an example and build out and we'll run the infrastructure out there and then we'll keep running it beyond that. And so now there's people beyond that that are dependent on the infrastructure we put in for Fleet Farm to actually serve them as well. Then the Fleet Farm goes away or the big box store goes away or you wind up with a store that is a lesser use, a lower tax paying use, or you get the dark store phenomenon, which we can talk about, which kind of artificially lowers tax rates for these large corporations. What happens then is they, in a sense, as part of the marriage, can walk away, but we as a community cannot. And so this asymmetry of obligation is a huge problem that cities in chasing growth in this way don't often stop to consider. We're making a forever promise. They're making a short-term revenue promise on a building that is really hard to adapt and recycle to a different use.
Thanks for that call. We're talking to Charles Marone, founder and president of the group Strong Towns, with us today. After a recent report showed local government debt is at record levels across Wisconsin, Chuck's group says sprawling development is part of the problem, causing financial instability for communities around the country. Still time for you to join in at 800-642-1234. Are you facing these questions in your own community, large or small? What questions do you have for our guest? Call 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation about financial instability in our towns and cities, high levels of debt in Wisconsin communities and elsewhere, and whether the way we do development these days is part of the problem. Charles Marone stays with us from the group Strong Towns. You can join in at 800-642-1234 if you want to share a story from your community, a question for our guest. What do you want to see local leaders look at when it comes to what to do with often scarce resources? Call 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Chuck, you have a different vision for when local leaders sit down, community members sit down and try to figure out, hey, where do we put our resources to develop a community? What would you like to see it look like?
Well, at the end of the day, if we're trying to make good financial investments that actually make our communities wealthier, lead to a higher quality of life, lower tax rates, that kind of thing. Those investments don't look like the big project. Those investments tend to look more like a collection of smaller things. When we can thicken up our neighborhoods, when we can take and add more ratepayers to a segment of pipe, add more units of housing to a neighborhood, when we can get that old store that's on the existing system that's kind of in a rundown state, you know, built up a little bit and reactivated and a new business in there. Those things tend to cost very little in terms of capital, but have an immense effect on the overall tax base. If we can grow our tax base by 5% over what just general inflation will be, our communities will get rich. I mean, they really will start adding a lot of wealth without adding any additional expense, really. And, you know, if we look at, I don't think we should think of cities as a business, but cities can use business principles to understand what is going on in them. And if we think about it for a moment in that way, what we find is that the quality of life things, making your parks better, adding street trees, making it easier for people to bike and walk, these are actually the best financial investments that we can make in a place because they're relatively cheap and they spread out a lot of wealth or a lot of value increase over a really broad area, which is, you know, ultimately what you're trying to do.
It seems like there's a certain political incentive to go in the other direction. If I'm a politician, I could show up at a ribbon cutting for the new development or the new bridge or what have you. I can't show up at the ribbon cutting to fill that pothole or plant that tree. It doesn't sound as exciting.
It's funny because the politicians that the local politicians that do this really well, they have ribbon cuttings every day, you know, for filling potholes and fixing up the park and planting trees. They just do it differently, right? They're very smart about it. And in a kind of a social world, you know, where we use social media, it's one of those things where instead of having the one big event during your administration, you've got 1,000 small ones, and it's much more effective politically. I think the political problem, if we want to talk about it, is the way that the state and the federal government approach these things. I mean, you do have when the state of Wisconsin gives cities monies to build infrastructure or helps subsidize that approach, when the federal government does likewise, when we have artificially low interest rates, what we wind up doing is encouraging cities, giving them massive incentives to do these things that are in short-term interests of the state and federal government. State government makes their money off of income tax. They make their money off of sales tax. So transactions are really great for them. Same with the federal government. What they don't do, either the state or federal government, is take on that long-term promise to fix that street, to maintain that pipe. So what you have is a system where the dialogue, the conversation, the incentives, the way we even talk about this from a top-down standpoint, is all about the next big project that we can do. And that's really not in the interests of cities. It's not in the interests of local governments, and it's not in the interests of the people who live in them.
On the demand side of things, I think there's a notion about Americans, maybe a caricature, that we don't want denser development, taking more intense advantage of our local infrastructure. We want to live away from downtown. We want to drive to that big box store and park in the parking lot with plenty of spaces for us to park in. True or false?
I think that there is a big element of truth to that. But it's always important to point out that all of these things come at a price point. The most expensive real estate in North America is in Manhattan. New York City and San Francisco, two of the densest cities in the United States. If you go and talk to people there, they will tell you that they like living there, they want to live there, and they're willing to pay high amounts of money to do that. I think if you have very nice places, if you have places where the parks are well maintained, the sidewalks are well maintained, there's great street trees, you've got good urban design, people tend to prefer those places over the more windy, cul-de-sac-y, beige-ish, you know, kind of development every day. There's a huge premium that people will pay to live in those type of complete neighborhoods, a neighborhood with a coffee shop up the street and a local butcher and a local florist and all these things. That used to just be development. That used to just be how we built things. I think that there's a stated preference today, perception, because that is the only thing that the market really creates. And every time we see something different created in the market, we see it gobbled up faster than it can be built at a premium price.
On the other hand, I've kind of pointed toward the opposite political view. I think most people want their water to work and their electricity and their roads to not have potholes and things like that. How can we, I guess, develop that as a constituency if that's the kind of thing we want?
Well, and most people want their taxes to be low or reasonable. And most people want, I mean, there's a whole list of things in terms of, you know, just the core competencies of government that people expect. I think it's important to recognize that the people of Detroit did not wake up one day and decide that they didn't care how their local government ran. It just slowly fell apart. We have had this introspection this year about Jackson, Mississippi and their water problem. That did not develop in the last 6 months. That's been a slow rolling disaster over a long period of time. When we step back and we look at cities across North America, when we look at cities across Wisconsin, what we see is the same kind of slow building disaster taking place in each and every one of them. It's not because they're poorly run. It's not because the people there are incompetent or greedy or short term. It's because the underlying development model is the same development model that bankrupted Detroit. It's the same development model that has bankrupted Jackson, Mississippi. And it is slowly grinding all of these cities down. And you know, what you see as a result is higher taxes, lower levels of service, and growing levels of debt. And this most recent report just kind of affirms that this is the overall trend that we see in our cities. It's just another data point to kind of affirm the fact that this development model is not working long term for our local governments.
Chuck, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Hey, thanks so much for having me. You take care.
You too. That's Charles Marone, founder and president of the group Strong Towns, with us today to make the case for a return to incremental development, smaller scale development in towns and cities after a recent report showed local debt at record levels in Wisconsin. Coming up after the news, it's Food Friday. A chef based in the Midwest joins us to talk about indigenous cooking traditions and their relevance to our culture and health and the food we eat. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we want to hear from you about a TV show you watch or watched as a kid that was from before your time. Let us know right now on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Now, it's Food Friday. Our guest is an internationally recognized chef focused on indigenous cuisine. He's on a mission to cook with indigenous ingredients, meaning those here in North America pre-colonization. He's hoping to revive cultural traditions around food, and he says it's a healthy way to eat. Also, tasty. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about indigenous food ingredients and recipes and cultural traditions and how they fit into American cuisine now? Are there Native American dishes you've enjoyed maybe as a diner, maybe part of your own family's food tradition? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Sean Sherman, also known as the Sioux Chef, is Oglala Lakota. He's a chef serving indigenous foods at his restaurant, Owamni, based in Minneapolis. It won a James Beard Award. He specializes in wild food usage and harvesting, food preservation, salt and sugar making, while recognizing native culture and history. Sean's the author of the book, The Sioux Chef's Indigenous Kitchen. Sean, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Before we get into your mission and the why, last time we talked to you was 2014. You were just embarking on being involved in a food truck. You've done a lot since then. Can you talk about how this your mission and your work has progressed over the last 8 years or so?
Yeah, we've done a lot. You know, we launched that food truck. It was called Tatanka Truck here in Minneapolis. We started a catering company that ran all the way up until the pandemic. We released the cookbook, which was the Sioux Chef's Indigenous Kitchen, which won a James Beard Award for Best American Cookbook in 2018. We launched a nonprofit called NATIFS, which is an acronym for North American Traditional Indigenous Food Systems, which also landed another James Beard Award in 2019 for leadership. And then we finally opened up Awamni in 2021 in July, and we've been sold out pretty much every day since opening. And we won the James Beard Award for best new restaurant in the entire nation, which was a pretty big one.
Well, congratulations on all that since the last time I talked to you. Give us a sense of where your mission started. You were working, you were on the restaurant scene. What steered you in this direction of indigenous ingredients and foods?
Well, you know, I grew up on Pine Ridge Reservation in South Dakota, so I'm enrolled with the Oglala Lakota Sioux Tribe, and I moved to Minneapolis shortly after college from South Dakota and started working restaurants and just kind of moved my way up rather quickly into a chef career at a pretty young age. And a few years into that career, I just kind of realized the complete absence of indigenous culinary anywhere out there. There was very few cookbooks, there was no restaurants, and it just was something that had to change. So I spent quite a few years just researching to understand what my ancestors were eating, how were they preserved. Serving foods, you know, what were they cooking? What were they using for salts and fats and sugars? And then started searching, like who was still holding on to indigenous seeds, who had a really good knowledge of the plants out there, and just started piecing together kind of a philosophy of the work that we do today.
And you cover a wide variety of traditions. When we think of Native American food, I think we have to throw the S out. We're talking about foods and cultures and traditions. Can you talk about just the diversity, the variety of food traditions around the continent?
So much. I mean, North America is gigantic, and we look at North America from Mexico through Alaska, and there's just so much to understand. There's so much diversity. You know, there's 476 tribes in the U.S., 622 in Canada, and there's, you know, there's 20% of Mexico identifies as indigenous, and we're just trying to showcase all this amazing regional and cultural diversity that's out there. And there's a lot of work to do, but, you know, we're starting, and we've been working really hard for quite the past few years, and there's a large, you know, indigenous food sovereignty movement happening all over the U.S., including around here in Minnesota and Wisconsin.
Can you talk about some of the ingredients that that weren't showing up in the restaurants you were working in that you've turned to and found sources for, maybe cultivated those sources for? What kind of foods, what kind of ingredients are we talking about?
Well, you know, we cut out ingredients that were introduced by Europeans primarily, so things that weren't from here. So we removed dairy products, wheat flour, cane sugar, beef, pork, chicken. So we focus on a lot of wild game, a lot of wild birds, a lot of wild fish, and we just use a lot of wild food products in general. So we've been able to find all sorts of wonderful vendors. We try and purchase from indigenous producers first. You know, if you come to the restaurant, you're just going to find a lot more plant diversity. You know, there's a lot of interesting plants that grow here in the forests around Wisconsin, Minnesota, things like Labrador, wintergreen, wild gingers, bergamots, lots of white cedar and spruce and pines and tamarack and burdock and all sorts of amazing foods, you know. So it's just showcasing, like, we have this wonderful food system around us, and we should really be opening our eyes and seeing so much flavor and just region everywhere.
Talking to Sean Sherman, creator of the restaurant Awamni in Minneapolis, author of the book The Sioux Chef's Indigenous Kitchen, talking about his mission to bring back food traditions from around the country, Native Americans around history and the present day. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you have a question, that's 800-642-1234, or email ideas at WPR.org. You can find a recipe that Sean shared with us. It's at WPR.org/Food Friday. And Sean, I want to check out that recipe now. You sent us a wild rice pilaf with mushrooms, roasted chestnuts, and dried cranberries. Can you tell us a little bit about this? It sounds like a great thing to eat this time of year.
Yeah, it's just a really simple recipe. And, you know, we urge people to look around and try to find tribally produced and harvested wild rice, which grows on the lakes here. And it's not like the black wild rice you find in the grocery stores at all. So we're lucky that we have a lot of wild rice sources around us. And we just want people to be able to taste that and experience that. And this is just a really simple recipe, and something that you can find a similar recipe on at the restaurant at Awamni in downtown Minneapolis.
And talk a little more about wild rice. I think if you quizzed people on the street, probably including me, and said, hey, name one Native American food ingredient, wild rice might be the first one to pop to mind. Can you talk about the wild rice scene today? Who's harvesting it? What is the network like in getting it for a restaurant or at home?
Well, we were using a group, the young couple that's here from Minnesota, close to Duluth. And we've been purchasing a lot of wild rice from them, but we purchase wild rice from many of the tribes around Minnesota, from Net Lake, from White Earth, from Red Lake. And but, you know, we have this really wonderful rice coming from a small, this small couple. They have a company called Native Wise, and it's just really beautiful. And, you know, we have all these different kinds of rice coming from all these different kinds of lakes in Minnesota. And when you lay them side by side, you can see all these nuances in color and length and size. And it's just something really special, you know, so we should be really proud of this rice that comes from these lakes. And we have friends out in Bad River that's growing out more rice. We have some friends in Menominee Nation out in Wisconsin also that's working on rice. And there's just, you know, there's a lot of stuff happening, but there's still rice out there. And, you know, there's people still trying to protect those waters and harvest that really wonderful just food source. And we're happy to be able to showcase it.
And, you know, something that occurs to me as you're talking about that, you know, setting the food aside for a moment, it sounds like you're, I don't know, building this network and meeting so many people and extending this community of people interested in indigenous food. What has that been like for you?
You know, it's great. You know, it's a passion. You know, it's something that just has to be out there. You know, we hope that someday we can see Native American indigenous restaurants all across North America, no matter which direction you drive, and start to experience all this amazing cultural diversity that we have everywhere. And for a lot of tribal communities, it's just really important to try to get these foods back into these communities because food access is a real issue. I use my reservation as an example, because growing up on Pine Ridge, we had one grocery store to service an area the size of Connecticut. And there's just very little food sources out there for us when it comes to nutrition, you know. But if we can teach people how to look at the world around us like our ancestors used to, see food all around us and start to implement a lot more wild food, native agriculture, and to see more and more food products coming from native producers, like we feel like there's so much work to do, but we see a really clear path. So we're excited to be working hard on this issue.
Can you talk about recipe creation at your restaurant when you're starting to develop something new that you want to serve? What goes into that planning and development stage for you?
Well, we really just try to make recipes make sense, like especially regionally and seasonally and culturally. So we just like to use the native languages. We like to just think about food that, you know, where you can find it, you know. So if we have something that has wild rice in it, and maybe it has some hickory nuts, maybe it has some maple or some cranberries, and maybe some rabbit, like you can literally just stand in one spot around these forests and look around and see all those ingredients there, you know. So the food is completely different if you're in the Pacific Northwest or up in Alaska or Southwest or deep in Mexico or East Coast. And we just want people to really think about that regionality of foods and really tie that understanding that indigenous peoples have always had about those regions and all these wonderful foods that come from these very specific places.
I haven't been to your restaurant, I'll say, yet. I've got a kid going to college in Minneapolis, so I may pay a visit sometime fairly soon. But are your recipes focusing on, you know, Midwestern traditions in particular, or would there be something from an Alaskan tradition or Southwestern or fill in the blank?
Yeah, I mean, the large amount of our food is really from the Great Lakes regions up here, but we do feature some flavors from the Southwest or from deep in Mexico or from way up in Alaska sometimes. So we have that ability to be creative and to highlight and showcase all these things. And, you know, we have a large staff. We have a lot of Native people working with us, and a lot of us are coming from many, many different nations. And we just like to, you know, give our chefs some freedom to create and to explore. And we're not trying to recreate the past and make food, you know, like it's 1491, but we're trying to do something different and, you know, kind of evolve this food into the new generation and just kind of showcase what's possible for modern indigenous foods moving forward.
We're talking to Sean Sherman, a chef specializing in indigenous cooking. He works to bring in native culture, history, and ingredients to today's food scene. His restaurant, as we mentioned, is Awamni in Minneapolis. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you have a question for Sean, maybe about some of the ingredients he works with, if you forage for some of the things he just mentioned, love to hear from you where you find it, what kind of things you do with it. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We have a link to that recipe. We were talking about the wild rice pilaf with mushrooms, roasted chestnuts, and dried cranberries. You can find that at wpr.org/Food Friday. We'll continue our Food Friday conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we're picking up our talk with Sean Sherman, chef and owner of the restaurant Awamni, based in Minneapolis. Sean's with us today to talk about his work in educating people on indigenous foods. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 if you'd like. If you've encountered some of the ingredients we're talking about, if you have a question for Sean, 800-642-1234. Sean, one thing we haven't gotten into yet, I understand is important to you, is the health side of the foods you're working with.
Absolutely. You know, because since we cut out these colonial ingredients of dairy and flour and sugar, for example, like our entire menu is gluten-free, sugar-free, soy-free, pork-free, dairy-free. And, you know, we just, you know, it's a really healthy food base, you know, and plus we're using a lot more plant diversity, which is really good for us. We're utilizing a lot of just this game meat that just has a lot more nutrients in it. And it's just a really healthy food base, you know, and we just really want to see that because unfortunately on a lot of tribal communities, and because of that lack of food access, we have a lot of foodborne illnesses like obesity and heart disease and type 2 diabetes, and we want to be able to work towards changing that, you know. And you feel really good when you sit down at the restaurant and eat this food, and you might feel full, but you really like agrees with you, like your stomach doesn't get all crazy, and it's like clean burning energy food, you know. And we just think we should be eating healthier anyway, so we're happy to be able to showcase that.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Pete is with us now in La Crosse. Pete, hi.
Hi. Hey, Sean. Hey, I'm wondering about how does fowl fit into the Midwestern Native American diet? Geese, ducks, maybe grouse. And if they do fit into the diet, how do you get them? How do you catch them?
You have to be really fast. No, I'm teasing. No, we actually have a grower here in Minnesota that grows a bunch of woodland poultry for me. So we get turkey, we get geese, we get ducks, we get quails, and we even get some pheasants from them, which I know aren't indigenous, but you know they're all over the place. I grew up hunting them on Pine Ridge, and so we have all these wild birds. They're not wild, but they're like, you know, they're like free range birds, basically growing up in the forest in Minnesota. So you know, we've been able to get a lot of cool vendors. We have other game vendors. We use things like antelope and deer. Antelope and venison and rabbit and elk and bison, of course, and all sorts of wonderful lake fish since we're just surrounded by lakes, you know, walleyes and whitefish and northerns and trout. And, you know, there's so much stuff. And then also we're able to, you know, utilize some of the seafoods coming in from the coasts and really feature recipes there. So there's just a lot of cool proteins out there. We even do crickets. We have about, I think I'm going through about 15 pounds of crickets a week at the restaurant.
Just talked to a cricket farmer the other day. Pete, thanks a lot for that call. For the ducks and geese that Pete is interested in, what are some of your favorite ways to prepare them, Sean?
Well, it really depends. You know, we like stewing things. We like smoking things. Of course, we can cook things fresh, like some of the breasts sometimes. And there's just lots of ways. But, you know, we have many different recipes with all these different things. And we just have a lot of fun with it. Sometimes we'll dehydrate them. Sometimes we'll turn that dehydrated meat into powder. And we've just been creating hundreds of recipes over the past few years. So we'll continue to put out more cookbooks. There's another one in the works. It's a couple of years out, but it'll get out there. But people can still find the first cookbook. It's pretty popular and it's out there all over the internet. So just search for the Sous Chef's Indigenous Kitchen.
Thanks again for that call. We'll go to Kay now in Madison. Hi, Kay.
Hi. I'm wondering if you get any of your ingredients from Wisconsin.
Oh, good question, Sean.
Sometimes, you know, we have some friends with Ho-Chunk Nation. We've been able to get some from them. We've been able to get some stuff from Menominee Nation sometimes. We have quite a few friends out in Bad River. We get a bunch of fish from the Red Cliff Fishery, which is up north there by Madeline Island also. So we're always, you know, on the search for indigenous producers around us. So we do get some really wonderful products that come from Minnesota and Wisconsin.
Okay, great question. Thanks for calling in at 800-642-1234. Something you mentioned earlier, Sean, is preservation of foods. This is a cold stretch of winter here. This isn't the greatest foraging season. Can you talk about the different ways you preserve some of those ingredients?
Yeah, I mean, we dehydrate a lot. So we do a lot of dehydration, and we make all sorts of different dehydrated spices and herbs and pieces from trees like cedar. We use a lot of meats and fish. We smoke a lot of things too first. And there's just a lot of ways. And we do some pickling, you know, and sometimes we'll play around with some fermentation. So, I think there's lots of options for just preserving foods in general. And, you know, we're just having a fun time experimenting. And we even have a nonprofit kitchen here in Minneapolis called Indigenous Food Lab, where we have the ability to do a lot of experimentation to kind of further our own knowledge and education. And we're about ready to launch a native market space there in South Minneapolis under Indigenous Food Lab. So this community will have direct access to buying a lot of these cool products that are out there. So we can just share that with people.
It's Food Friday. We're talking to Sean Sherman. His restaurant, Awamni, is based in Minneapolis. He's the author of the book, The Sioux Chef's Indigenous Kitchen. Back to your calls at 800-642-1234. Jim is with us now in Delafield. Jim, hi.
Hello. How are you doing?
Good. What did you want to ask about?
I'm curious about how they spice their food. I know that's more... Yeah, well, let's just leave it at that. How do you spice the food? One question. And the second question is, do you have any plans of bringing a native cooking restaurant to the Madison area?
Well, it's possible for Madison for that last question. I've spent quite a few different events. I've been to quite a few different events over there in Madison. I've worked with the university. I've worked with some groups there. There's some native farms around there, and there's just a lot of work with native food, especially with the Ho-Chunk Nation so close. We've worked with them before in the past, and there's some really good stuff coming out of there, especially with my friend Elena Terry, who's a Ho-Chunk chef from that area. But, you know, there's all sorts of amazing seasonings, you know, because like, we have obviously salt is a seasoning, but we use a lot of wild herbs. We dehydrate a lot of things. There's a lot of wild mushrooms, a lot of berries. And, you know, we make our food extremely flavorful. So there's all sorts of stuff. So the more people learn about the plants around them, the more they see food and flavor everywhere. So there's a lot to experiment with. And it's just something different. You know, sometimes we'll call it ironically foreign.
Jim, thanks a lot for that call. I'll plug, we've talked to Elena Terry a couple few times. You can search the WPR.org archives if you want to check out those conversations. We'll go now to Mary with us in Madison. Mary, hi.
Hi. I'm wondering how you compare wild-raised versus farm-raised fowl and fish. To me, there's a difference, for instance, in salmon and the taste and some other things. And how do you compare them nutritionally?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's obviously a lot of comparison when it goes to farm-raised and wild. And, you know, if we can find purveyors that have access to wild foods and they're doing it sustainably, then we love to support them. But we do have a lot of friends that do have farm-raised stuff. We don't bring in a ton of salmon. We do sometimes when it's in season coming from the Pacific Northwest from some of our indigenous purveyors, or sometimes from Alaska. We were just up in Alaska this summer when the salmon were spawning. You know, here in this region, we just try to buy a lot of stuff very regionally. And we have two big native fisheries nearby us. One is Red Cliff, like I said, up by Madeline Island. And then we also have Red Lake in northern Minnesota that has a huge fishery, and we get a bunch of fresh walleye and stuff. There is different nutritional values, because the wild stuff will have different nutrients and, better fats, because we can't always guarantee what some of the farm-raised products are eating, you know. And so we do our best to really try to find really intentional purveyors that are doing their farms really well.
Mary, thanks a lot for that call. Sean, you've mentioned a couple times you are constantly looking to try new things, researching. You mentioned that basically a cooking lab you've got in the works in Minneapolis. What are you working on next? What things have you excited that you're developing now?
Well, I've been excited just to be able to travel around the nation quite a bit. I think we were in close to 50 cities and 8 countries this year. And it's really exciting to meet a whole bunch of different groups from different nations all over the United States and Canada and Alaska and Mexico. And just to really collaborate with a lot of indigenous peoples working on food sovereignty issues out there. There's just a bright future. So I'm excited about the cookbook that we're working on that'll come out in a couple of years. I'm excited about a lot of the projects with our nonprofit. We're already expanding our nonprofit into cities like Anchorage, Bozeman, and Rapid City, and we'll continue to build that and expand more and more. There's going to be a lot of opportunity to open up more restaurants that we'll just kind of take by ear and see how it goes. And there's even some, you know, video and TV situations on the horizon.
Sean, a lot in the works. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
We've been talking to Sean Sherman. Oglala Lakota Sioux, a chef and serving indigenous foods at his restaurant Awamini, based in Minneapolis. He specializes in wild food usage and harvesting, food preservation, salt and sugar making, while recognizing native cultures and histories. He's the author of the cookbook, The Sioux Chef's Indigenous Kitchen. Well, if you are hungry, so am I, you can find a recipe online at WPR.org/Food Friday. It's a recipe Sean shared with us. It is wild rice pilaf with mushrooms, roasted chestnuts, and dried cranberries. Be a great thing to serve maybe at a holiday gathering if you have one of those coming up. Maybe a little late to hit the grocery store. I don't know. But check it out. Let us know if you make it and let us know how it went. And hey, we've got a whole new year of Food Fridays to look ahead at in 2023. And we want to hear from you. What do you want to hear us talking about? What is something you'd like to add to your culinary repertoire in your kitchen? Let us know right now. You can email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. Coming up Monday on The Morning Show, get some help with your self-talk with advice from a psychologist. That's coming up Monday morning at 8 here on the Ideas Network. There are lots of best of 2022 articles and lists and conversations out there right now. On the first week of January, we're going to do one of those. We'll talk about some great TV shows from this year and ones to watch for in the new year. But in just a few minutes, we're going to take a different look at TV shows and look at shows we watch from before our time. That can be any era. Maybe you're a Gen Z person watching a show from the 1990s, or you grew up with syndicated reruns from the 1940s and 50s, all points in between. We want to hear from you now. What is that show or the shows from before you were born that you watched? How did you discover them? How did you watch them? Email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. You can join the list of people who have posted on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Or if you don't mind hanging out on hold for a couple few minutes, call now. 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll take your classic TV shows coming up here on Central Time.